This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Today, a sorely needed message of hope. If we just simply let nature take its course, we can restore the earth. We talk with Isabella Tree about her book, Wilding, The Return of Nature to a British Farm. It's out from Picador Press. Then we talk with Nation magazine contributor Jeet Heer about the Iowa caucus debacle, the progressive wing of the Democratic presidential campaign, and Michael Bloomberg on its billionaire wing. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for a free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. When Isabella Tree and her husband Charlie took over management of Charlie's family's farm, NEP, they tried to make a go with modern intensive farming practices. But the heavy clay soil fought back, and the couple ended up heavily in debt. So, in the year 2000, they tried something different, very different. They gave up farming and let the land go wild. Within a short period of time, they were seeing species that hadn't been seen in England in many decades. Managed with minimal human intervention and with herds of free-roaming animals driving the creation of new habitats, their rewilded land is now heaving with life. Rare species like turtle doves, nightingales, peregrine falcons, and purple emperor butterflies are now breeding at NEP, and biodiversity has rocketed. Isabella Tree, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is just such a wonderful and inspiring book, Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. First, tell us about NEP Castle Estate. It's been in your husband's family for generations, is that right?
Yeah, it was built for my husband's family. It was designed by the architect John Nash, so it's a Regency castle, and it was built about 220 years ago. So this estate has been in my husband's family ever since then.
Yes, and it must be very beautiful. Now, how large is it? And tell us a little bit about how it used to be before you began this amazing project of rewilding on it.
Well, it's 3,500 acres, and we inherited it from my husband's grandparents. So we moved here in the 1980s. And then it was pretty much all of the land was intensive arable and dairy. So it had been ploughed up during the Second World War during the Dig for Victory campaign, when there was a concerted effort to incentivize farmers to, well, landowners everywhere to plough up their land to provide as much food as possible. So this land really was never intended to, it doesn't suit modern agriculture at all. We sit on 320 meters of clay over a bedrock of limestone. I think the Inuit are supposed to have dozens of different words for different types of snow, aren't they? And in Sussex, we have over 35 words for different types of mud. That's how much the mud, the clay, governs our lives. So it was an intensive farm, but only really because that culture had kind of sunk in since the Second World War. Prior to that, it would have been permanent pasture. There would have been dairy and beef animals, perhaps a few sheep, but it wouldn't have been arable like it was when in the 1980s when we took over.
And it was a struggle to farm it. You did finally give up. So tell us a little bit about the 550-year-old oak that you talk about in this wonderful book, Wilding, and how it inspired you to change what you did at the farm.
Well, it was really a kind of epiphany, I suppose, looking back on it. We knew we were already facing huge problems with the farm. We were £1.5 million in debt. We just couldn't make a profit on this heavy clay, try as we might. But it just happened that we were concerned about a big oak tree. It is about 550 years old. It's just within a stone's throw of the house. And it had begun sort of pulling apart in the middle. And during the Second World War, when the Canadian Army was stationed at NEP, they had pulled it together, tied it together with tank chains. And that was sort of beginning to fail. So we pulled in this expert called Ted Green. He's now in his 80s. And he was the custodian of the Windsor Oaks, the Royal Oaks in Windsor Great Park. And he was judged to be the best man to come and tell us what to do about this tree. And he took one look at the tree and he said, it's in the prime of its life. Don't worry, it's got another 300 or 400 years to go. We'll just put in a few more wires to stabilize it, give it a bit of a haircut. It'll be absolutely fine. He said, what I'm really worried about, though, is those oak trees out in the landscape, in the what had been a Repton Park. It had been a landscape park around the house. And these trees, some of them 300, 400 years old, were beginning to die back. They were looking kind of very staggy. They had these kind of bare branches coming out of the top. They didn't have that lovely kind of bloom of broccoli that a very healthy tree is supposed to have. And Ted said, those trees are friends of mine, and I can tell when a friend of mine is looking unhealthy. And he said, it's all down to what you're doing. And we sort of were amazed. We said, well, what are we doing? And he said, well, you're plowing right up to the trunks. You're chopping up its roots and all the mycorrhizal fungi, that universal network under the ground that is the tree's life support system. And you're pouring chemicals on the soil. Every year that you're plowing, you're pouring nutrients, nitrates and artificial fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides. All these chemicals are drenching the soil, killing off all the soil biota, all the microbiota, all the fungi, and that is what is killing the tree. And we just couldn't believe it. I suppose we'd noticed the trees were dying back a little, but we assumed that was down to a kind of a natural process. Perhaps it was a drought or the big storm we had in 97. We never thought that it was down to us. And suddenly we began to look at the soil and what we were doing to the soil as farmers in a completely different way. And I think that's the moment we started on this journey of kind of turning around approach to what we were doing to the land.
And very much that turning around, well, it did involve some work on your part, but it was work that encouraged nature itself to do its thing. Tell us just a little bit about some of the first things that you did and how quickly you began to see some species come that are actually endangered or in decline in other places in the UK.
I think that was one of the most astonishing things. We originally, when we embarked on the rewilding project, we hoped that if we could increase biodiversity just a little, that would have been an experiment worth taking. But as it was, you know, we've just been astounded by the rebound of nature. It just shows that given half a chance, nature will bounce back. We've now got all 5 UK species of owls. We've got 13 out of the 17 breeding species of bat, including 2 bats, Bechstein and Barbasol bat, which are so rare, they're rare even in Europe. We've got some of our rarest birds, including the nightingale, which is critically in decline, and the bird that's most likely to go extinct from Britain in the next 10 years or so is the turtle dove. And we now have 20 singing males on NEP last summer. And we know they're breeding because we've been able to ring a few fledglings. So we're probably the only place in Britain now where there are breeding numbers, rising numbers of turtle doves, which is just astonishing. We've got so many red data species, endangered species that, I mean, you know, I could go on listing them. But what's astounded us is not just the rarity of the birds that are coming back, but also the biomass, the sheer volume of life that's out there now. So that's changing the way that scientists think about what the land is capable of holding. When you go out on a spring day in the early morning and listen to the dawn chorus, the birdsong is so loud that it just reverberates in your stomach. It's quite astounding.
Yes, it is. You know, something that I've noticed over the last couple of decades, it used to be that when I went out in my car, I'd always have to clean my windshield. And I haven't had to clean my windshield of insects for a very, very long time. And then a few years ago, we learned why, which is that 75% of the insects have disappeared. 30% of the birds have disappeared. You have seen an amazing resurgence of insects coming back in a very short period of time. And they are the basis of the food chain.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing we noticed first of all, was that very first summer that we walked out of the doors after we'd committed to rewilding was the sound of the insects. It was something we hadn't even known as farmers that we'd been missing. And now we have, as you say, we have that moth snowstorm. We have to put our windscreen wipers on, you know, if we're driving at night, because of the insects splattering on the windscreen again. It's something that I hadn't known since I was a child in the 1960s. If you're cycling out there in the summer, you have to put on sunglasses because you get thwacked in the eyeball with insects. That's how it used to be. And we've completely forgotten that. And it's, of course, because of the insects that, you know, we have some of these amazing birds coming back. And the bats, of course, are feasting on these burgeoning populations of insects. But it's not just the flying insects, it's also really important keystone species like dung beetles. So obviously now we're not putting wormers and antibiotics into the livestock anymore. Everything out there is purely organic. So we have all this organic dung from our free-roaming animals, from our old English longhorns, from the Exmoor ponies, from the red deer and the fallow deer, and even our Tamworth pigs. And that is proving a feast for dung beetles. And of course, dung beetles pull down the dung into the soil to make chambers for their larvae. And that is a fantastic way of returning nutrients and soil structure. My husband's turned into a bit of a dung beetle fetishist, and I couldn't work out what he was doing the other day. He was following the cattle, and every time one of them did a cowpat, he would drop to his stomach next to the cowpat, and with his mobile phone. And I couldn't work out what he was doing, but he was timing how long it took the dung beetles to find that cowpat. And I think the record was 60 seconds. That's how fast they find it. And then he started kind of doing experiments in the kitchen, which wasn't quite so popular, looking at how many dung beetles he could find in the cowpat. And he found 23 different species of dung beetle in a single cowpat, including one dung beetle, the violet door beetle, which hasn't been seen in Sussex for 50 years. So that's the astonishing thing. These creatures are clinging on to little scraps, tiny fragments of habitat out there in the landscape. And as soon as they find us and the habitat is right for them, then the populations explode.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Isabella Tree about her book, Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. It's just, in a time when all the news around us is so despairing, this was really a wonderful experience of hopefulness in reading this book. You say organic. There are a lot of organic farms. Is a similar thing happening with them? Or because this is really not agriculture you're practicing, it's rewilding. So what's the difference?
Well, there's a big difference because we're obviously focused on nature here and on restoring natural processes. So we're not primarily about producing food. We do actually produce food off the project because we cull the animals to keep the numbers very low, the stocking density very low, so that you have this really interesting interaction with the vegetation. It's one of the primary processes in nature, as it were, this influence of animal disturbance, which churns up the soil, which interacts with vegetation, creates structural complexity, and that creates all the margins where life thrives. So we keep the stocking levels very low. So we are producing meat off the project. We produce about 75 tons of organic, free-roaming, pasture-fed meat. But otherwise, we are not producing food, certainly not in the quantities that we did before. We're producing other things for the benefit of the public, of course. We're mitigating against floods because now our land holds on to water in times of flood. We're restoring the soil. We know that our soils have double the soil carbon, three times the mycorrhizal fungi, three times the soil biota. And of course, we're cleaning the air. The vegetation is actually taking pollutants out of the air. And our soils are actually taking pollutants out of the water, so that water that runs onto NEP that's polluted from surrounding farmland or from the roads, once it's been through our soils and our vegetation, it's actually of the purest quality it could be. So we are producing other services, as it were, for the public good. But really, we're very different to farming. That's not to say that, you know, farming should carry on as it is. I think everywhere that we're producing food, we have to shift into regenerative agriculture. We've got to stop ploughing. We've got to stop using chemicals on the land. And we know, thanks to farmers in the States like Gabe Brown and David Montgomery, that regenerative farming can produce just as much food as conventional farming, but with no inputs whatsoever. So we have to shift to regenerative farming. But you'll never get the same wildlife on areas of intensive food production as you get from rewilded areas, because you're not focusing on the habitat so much. Obviously, you'll get soil biota in your regenerative agriculture, you'll get birds, and you'll have insects, pollinating insects, hopefully, particularly. But you won't get that sort of real dynamism of the kind of boom and bust cycles you get when you allow nature to perform, when you give it the space and the time to do those cycles, to actually function in a fully ecological way that you get from rewilding.
One of the first things that you did shocked me. You established a field of wildflowers in place of what had been there before. But first, you had to sterilize the field with the herbicide glyphosate. That sounds so horrible. Tell us, why did you do that, and how did you feel when you had to apply this, you know, this chemical that is implicated in, you know, reproductive hazards and cancer to the land?
It was very counterintuitive. It felt really like making a patient sicker before it had to get better. Really, the idea was trying to kill off the competition. And, you know, we also reaped kind of hay off the land for a couple of years we carted it off the land, so that you're really using that first vegetation growth to soak up some of the nitrates and the phosphorus that you've been artificially adding to the land, and impoverishing the land again so that it's suitable for growing wildflowers and native grasses again. But sometimes there are interventions you need to do to try and kickstart natural processes again. It's kind of moving the land. If you can kind of imagine that after years of mismanagement by humans, it's got undergone what scientists call a catastrophic shift. And so in order to reestablish the natural processes again, there are sometimes drastic action you have to take just to reset the table, as it were. But I'm not sure we would use glyphosate again. In other areas where we've rewilded at a later stage, we didn't do that. We simply let the arable fields go after their last harvest. We didn't do anything. And in fact, we've found that the wildflower species and the native grasses come back on their own anyway. Mm. And it's not only much cheaper, because you don't have to spend a fortune on this gold dust of native seeds, but it's also a much more natural way of doing it. So I think we've learned from that, and we wouldn't probably use glyphosate again.
Now, you mentioned before some of the grazing animals. The fallow deer were the first major wildlife to help the land recover. They are, I've never seen deer like that. I looked up a picture of them. They have the most remarkable antlers. They're a real link to the past. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they've got these wonderful palmated antlers, a bit like your moose, which we would call elk over here. But they are a link back to the times of the Romans, actually. The Romans first introduced them. They died out with the Romans when the Romans left, but then the Normans introduced them into deer parks, really for hunting. So back in the day, in King John's day, in the sort of 11th, 12th centuries, you would have had a deer park. Knepp would have been an emparked area used for hunting deer and wild boar. So in many ways, we've gone back to that early medieval landscape. It would have been much more open. It would have been called a forest. But of course, in the old days, a forest didn't mean closed canopy. It meant somewhere that you hunted for deer. So it would have had open grown oaks. It would have had areas of scrub, water meadows, grazing lawns, as they would have been called, where you have your herds grazing and moving around. It would have been a much more dynamic, sort of shifting kaleidoscope of habitats in medieval times. And that's very much the landscape, I think, that has come back under rewilding. It's driven by these free roaming animals, and that's what creates the dynamism.
The key is also other grazing animals, not just the deer, but there are horses. So you talk about ponies, pigs, and longhorn cattle. That's one of your chapter headings. Talk about this interrelationship between these different, you know, top species in some ways, and how they operate, they occupy different places in this complex web of nature.
That's what's so interesting, I think, is the more of these large herbivores, the more megafauna you can put back into a landscape, the more complex the vegetation becomes, the more biodiverse the habitats, the more dynamism there is. The way they graze, the way they browse, they all have different eating preferences, different mouthpieces. You think of cows, which essentially just have bottom teeth, compared to a pony or a horse, which has top teeth as well, that can nibble very delicately, very accurately. They all have different ways, different strategies of eating, different ways of marking out their territory. A red deer will turf up the grass with its antlers in the rut. The fallow deer will create these huge lekking grounds where they urinate over huge areas and have these big clashing battles to compete for the females. Everything these animals do opens up a niche for other life. And we're beginning to see, too, the kind of relationship they have between with each other. So equines and bovines, we're beginning to understand, have a very intimate relationship. I think Princeton University are doing some really interesting studies in Kenya at the moment. And what they've shown, I think, is so illustrative of rewilding. It's very counterintuitive, but it kind of makes sense when you understand it. What they've found is that if you have 100 head of cattle in a given area and they're allowed to graze with an equine, and that could be a horse, it could be a zebra, it could be a donkey, those 100 head of cattle will put on more condition than if they graze that same area on their own. And you think, well, how could they do that? They must be competing for resources. But in fact, they're not. What the horses do is they take out all the rough grasses. At Knepp, we see the ponies eating thistles a lot. The kind of stuff that cows simply can't stomach. And because they take out that rough stuff, it enables the sweeter grasses to come through, the softer foliage that the cows can then benefit from. So, you know, I have in my head this sort of idea that in the past you would have had herds of auroch, herds of tarpan, the original horses, moving through the landscape. And in their wake, you would have had herds of aurochs, the original cow, benefiting from the habitat that the tarpan had created from them.
I told Isabella Tree that I lived in the middle of a forest on the east end of Long Island, one that's lost a lot of biodiversity.
What's so interesting is if you read the diaries of the early, you know, the pioneers in the settlers in America, they describe the eastern seaboard of America as being very much like an English parkland landscape. And that's because you would have had wood bison having a big effect on ring barking and destroying trees. You would have had apex predators in that landscape too, who would have been keeping down numbers of the deer. So you'd have had a much fuller ecology. And that itself would have been keeping the landscape much more open. We tend to think of closed canopy forests as somehow being a kind of a natural state of nature. But we forget that there would have been huge numbers of animals in that landscape that would have been interacting with the emerging scrub and trees, and that would have created a much more open landscape. And if you think about how important sunlight is to vegetation, particularly to flowering plants and to plants that are producing berries and seeds and nuts that are going to be eaten by other wildlife, they need sunlit conditions. There are very few species that tolerate complete shade, closed canopy woodland. So I think wherever you see closed canopy woodland, you know, a question mark needs to come up into our heads. Is this really natural? What are we missing here? What big animals should be here to trash it a bit, to open it up? And of course, if you think back into the far distant past, there would have been many, many more animals, megafauna in America. Camelids, for example, I think you had 5 species of camel. The camel came from America in the first place. Horses, mammoths, mastodons, you would have had giant sloths, you would have had huge numbers of enormous heavy-hitting megafauna that would have been opening up this so-called, you know, forest, this Eden idea that we have in our heads. And so I think that's what we've discovered here at NEP, is that by using free-roaming herbivores in this way, they are, in essence, a keystone species. The way they interact with vegetation can kickstart natural processes again. It can hold back the succession of trees, and that is not necessarily a bad thing. Of course, we need trees in our landscape, but we don't necessarily need them closed canopy and everywhere. What we need is the dynamism and that shifting kaleidoscope that so many species need. So many species depend on different habitats in their life cycle. And that's what we need, is that rubbing up together of different habitats to facilitate all these different species.
Yes, and there's a very important place for the lowly scrub, for bushes. You know, I wonder if you could talk about that, because that's something I have never heard of before. And of course, the tendency of so many farmers and other people as well is just to, you know, cut down every bit of brush imaginable so you can create something that looks, you know, pristine.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, how what control freaks we are. And, you know, certainly in the UK, you know, scrub is considered wasteland. People look at it and they think it's an abomination, and you know, put in big machines, you can get rid of it in hours, minutes sometimes. We just have zero tolerance for it. But scrub is one of the most biodiverse habitats there is, and particularly if it's thorny scrub. So in the UK, we have species like bramble, dog rose, hawthorn, blackthorn. As soon as you've got thorny scrub, gorse even, it offers huge protection for nesting birds, for small mammals, even for insects, to keep them safe from predation. That's where you see the insects, the butterflies, the dragonflies, all hovering is in that margin where they can keep away from predation. And so it's hugely biodiverse. And of course, it's how trees naturally regenerate in the landscape without human intervention. It's nature's barbed wire in a way. So in the UK, we have a wonderful bird called the jay, you know, a bit like your jay, but our jay can plant 6,000 acorns. One bird can plant 6,000 acorns in 4 weeks. And it will do that by planting them near a piece of thorny scrub where it can remember a vertical, that it will be able to remember where it stashed them. And that's where you see these new oaks popping up, protected as they grow by the thorny scrub from even browsing by rabbits or browsing by deer. So thorny scrub really is nature's way of regenerating trees in the presence of grazing and browsing animals.
You mentioned, Isabella Tree, you mentioned the intolerance for scrub. You faced a lot of resistance from local farmers about that and the other things that you've done with the whole rewilding project at NEP. Has this local opposition shifted over the years, and how have you weathered it, if not?
Yeah, we had a lot of opposition in the early days. We had, shed loads of letters being delivered to our door. We had poems written to the local newspaper about ragwort, which is considered an injurious weed, and we shouldn't be, tolerating it at all in our landscapes. I think it was understandable in the early days. We've grown up with this picture postcard idea of how our British landscape should look like. It's manicured, it's micromanaged, it's got neat edges, canalized rivers, everything is controlled, and it somehow makes us feel secure. And we've come to consider that as beautiful. It's very much a sort of an aesthetic that is in our cultural DNA. And so obviously if you're used to looking at that so-called beautiful landscape across your fence and you see, it's been left to rack and ruin, and suddenly you've got thistles and docks and ragwort, you've got thorny scrub popping up and animals trampling the place and pigs rootling, you're going to be horrified. And I think it took a while for that sort of horror to simmer down. I think it began when we started to hear nightingales again, when suddenly the bird song erupted. Slowly our neighbours, I think, began to realise that there was method in our madness. And of course, once those dramatic early stages are over, the vegetation begins to calm down a little bit. The animals, you get used to seeing them, and they start interacting with the vegetation, so there's not so much growth. And I think then slowly people's aesthetics began to change. We had a letter from one particular woman in the early days, Charlie, saying, "Your grandparents would be rolling in their graves. What you've done is turned something beautiful into an abomination." And the same woman wrote to us last year apologizing, and she said, I was early off the mark. I didn't really know what I was saying. I felt affronted because the change happened very quickly and it made me quite fearful. But now I'm beginning to understand that NEP is still beautiful. It's just different. It's beautiful in a different way. And I think more than anything, that made me realize that people's minds can change. The mindset can change. We've now joined a farm cluster of 31 farmers, neighbors of ours, all looking at ways in which they can get nature back onto their land and that they can do something for wildlife. They're not going to rewild, at least not yet. Maybe one or two of them will do eventually. But, everyone's on a journey. And I think there's definitely more interest now in getting nature back onto farmland. I think we're beginning to understand how we've abused the soil, how we've destroyed wildlife and biodiversity, and that it's not sustainable. And there's a really interesting shift out there, a real movement, a real hunger to work with nature and get wildlife back. And I think that's just incredibly exciting.
Yes, it is. In fact, is it E.O. Wilson who said we need to set aside half the earth for wildlife? What do you think of that?
Yes. I mean, I he's amazing, obviously, E.O. Wilson. And yes, he's saying that if we want to recover the systems that support life on Earth, including our own life as a species, we have to give over half of the Earth's landmass back to nature. So how are we going to do that? It's not enough to just have our nature consigned to wilderness areas, ghettoizing it to given nature reserves. We've got to be generous. We've got to accept and encourage nature back into our own backyards. And how do we do that? Well, I think rewilding shows us a way that we can do it. We can do it on marginal land that's not suitable for food production. We can do it very quickly. We've seen how quickly nature can bounce back. But we can do it in our own back gardens. And I think in the UK, we have 1 million acres of garden are under private gardens, which is more than we have under nature reserves. So that's a huge influence. If we could manage those gardens for wildlife rather than trying to eradicate wildlife within them, particularly by stopping using pesticides and herbicides. That's a huge influence, a huge plus for biodiversity. And then, of course, if we can connect them, if you can connect all the gardens in one street, even if it's by so much as just opening up a hole in the hedge or a hole in the fence for hedgehogs so that they can move through, suddenly you've got a wildlife corridor. And that becomes exponentially influential on biodiversity. So I think it's all about everybody doing their bit and then connecting so that suddenly you have populations of wildlife beginning to move again and react in terms of climate change and become more resilient for the future. I think we have to think of our little piece of land, even if it's a window box, and how it fits into the bigger picture.
Well, your book, Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm, Isabella Tree, is such an important step in bringing that awareness and consciousness to the wider public. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. It is indeed inspiring.
Pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Isabella Tree writes for publications such as National Geographic and Granta. Her articles have been selected for the Best American Travel Writing and Reader's Digest Today's Best Nonfiction, and she was overall winner of the TravelX Travel Writer Awards. She's the author of 5 books. Next up, Jeet Heer weighs in on the Iowa caucus debacle, the 2020 election, and Michael Bloomberg after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. Last week, I scheduled an interview with Nation contributor Jeet Heer. Then, the Iowa caucus app meltdown happened, and today, February 5th, we still don't know who won. Pete Buttigieg declared victory with 0 results in, and after having invested some $40,000 in the company that created the app. And Bernie Sanders' campaign isn't making any declarations about the final result, but they have the receipts because they developed their own app, anticipating problems with the official ones. Jeet Heer has been watching all the developments, and we checked in with him about 2 pieces he wrote for The Nation. The first argues that the progressive wing of the 2020 Democratic campaign, encompassing Sanders and Warren, is the most electable, and the party moderates need to coalesce behind it in the interests of party unity. His second piece, Michael Bloomberg is the rich man's Donald Trump, argues that it's time to vet the candidate on the basis of the dangers of plutocracy. Well, Jeet Heer, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Had a late night last night, as maybe some of your listeners did, because I was following the Iowa results, which turned into a real roller coaster that has not ended yet.
Yes, exactly. I stayed up pretty late, too. And before we get into talking about some of two of your recent pieces in The Nation, I'd just like to ask you about your take on what happened last night.
Well, I mean, I think the politest way to say it was, I guess we can say a screw-up. I mean, I think that we'll probably get more reporting, but it does seem that one of the issues was, it goes back to 2016, that there had been the Iowa results, and the process is very murky, and there wasn't transparency. And so the Bernie Sanders people, after 2016, at the convention, one of the things they demanded was, you know, greater transparency and clarity with Iowa. And the way the Iowa Democratic Party seems to have responded is to make it even more complex. And that created this kind of like layers of problems. Then they added an app into this, which apparently wasn't working. So we're not going to get the full results for a while, probably not even today. But I mean, we kind of have a broad outline of what the results are, because it's an open process. People can sort of do the counting in the rooms. And I think all the campaigns know what the results are. And I think we can have a pretty fair sense of what it is as well.
And so what is your sense of that?
Well, I think that Bernie, it looks like the Sanders campaign came out on top, followed by Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren. And I think the big story is that Joe Biden, it seems, came in fourth and possibly fifth, a distant fourth. And I think that's like going to be the big news coming out of this once we do get the results. And I think the Biden campaign was actually saying that, like, because the process is so flawed, you know, maybe we shouldn't have results at all. And I think there's a reason why they're saying that, because if Biden came in fourth, you know, they put a lot of resources into Iowa. It doesn't play to all their strengths, but still, like, for someone who's allegedly a front runner to come in fourth, fifth is a very poor showing.
Yes, and also he has about the lowest amount of funding, and this is certainly going to hurt his funding. What do you think of the fact that Pete Buttigieg declared victory without any of the precinct's results?
Yeah, I thought that was not a very good thing to do. I mean, but it seems like you know, he has a background in management consulting, and maybe that's the kind of thing that they teach in that world. You know, like it's the old Al Haig thing. I'm in charge here. You know, you take a chaotic situation and you use it to assert authority. I thought that was not very good. And it kind of forced the hand of the other campaigns to kind of, like, you know, show their numbers, which do not show him as winning. So, and later this morning, he walked it back, saying he meant they were victorious in a metaphorical sense. So I feel that that's kind of, I don't know, kind of weaselly behavior.
We symbolically won.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, no, we don't know who officially won. The results are still going to be tabulated. We'll find out. We have a broad outline of what it's likely to be. And I think he tried to maximize the chaos, but in a way that, you know, it's sort of made a very poor impression in my view.
Yes, and you know, one interesting thing is I actually am a volunteer for the campaign, and so I know that Bernie's folks had their own app with which they were recording the results, and that was something that was possible because of the nature of the caucus. Everybody's in the room, you can see what's happening, there are pictures. You know, a lot of people are criticizing the caucus process, and certainly the problem was that it, you know, was chaotic. But that kind of accountability isn't possible in a regular primary vote, where, you know, especially if people are using election machines that have no paper trail.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's just a really good argument for paper trails, and there will be paper trails in Iowa, so that's all to the good. And in fact, some of the transparency that we have this time comes from the Bernie campaign of 2016. I mean, they definitely pushed for more transparency. So I mean, I think that's also good. I think people need to be calm about this in the sense that we will, I think, get the results, unless they listen to Joe Biden's argument, which is to never release the results. But I think the results will come in. I think, yeah, going forward, I mean, I absolutely think that, you know, like these electronic devices, computer voting, that's all very problematic. And the other thing is you need, like, nonpartisan professional government-run organizations. I mean, like, I don't know any other advanced democracy that does it this way.
Yeah, exactly. Now, your piece in The Nation, the electability argument is really about party unity. I'm going to ask you about that as well as a later piece that appeared today about Mike Bloomberg. But let's go to the first one. You wrote that before the Iowa caucuses. It came out January 29th. But in it, you say that there could be an easy path for victory for Sanders if Biden doesn't do well. And in fact, he did less well than all the polling said he would. So tell us, what is the path for victory for Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think the path for victory is that it's just the coalition that he's assembled, which is, like, you know, he has the most donations, the most volunteers. It looks like he got the most support in Iowa. He's polling well in New Hampshire and Nevada. And if he wins the first three of the primary states, and Joe Biden collapses, and he's collapsing, then the state that Sanders has a problem with is South Carolina, and he could win that too. So it does seem like if you look at, like, the broad numbers, the two candidates that have the most plausibility are Biden and Sanders. And if Biden is out of the way, then it's, you know, Sanders is the most plausible. I think that the other candidates, and for better or worse, they don't quite have that coalition. They're all kind of struggling with people of color, whereas, like, you know, Sanders, if you measure, does the best among people of color. He has the most multiracial coalition and the coalition with the broadest working class support.
And, of course, this has occasioned a panic in the Democratic elites and the never-Trumpers like David Frum and Jennifer Rubin. You turn your attention to another piece by Jonathan Chait, who, as you point out, famously insisted in 2015 that Donald J. Trump could never become president. Give us a critique that you have of Jonathan Chait's piece.
Sure. Chait, like, kind of lays out what he considers to be the electability argument against Sanders, that he's too extreme, that he has baggage from various points in his history. And, I mean, one obvious point is that, like, this is true of all the candidates, and is it true of the president as well? But beyond that, I think Chait mentions in the piece that, like, in an age of polarization, things that traditionally counted against the candidate don't matter so much. And I think Trump himself shows that. And it's significant that Chait was wrong about Trump. He actually said he welcomed Trump. He would be great if Trump were the nominee for the Democrats in 2016, on the assumption that this guy's unelectable. But what happened in 2016 was that the Republicans rallied behind Trump because they hated Hillary Clinton so much and they hated Democrats so much, that you have polarization. And in that environment, you know, really no one is unelectable. And I think, I mean, really, my bottom line is, if Donald Trump can be president, anyone can be president. And then the issue is that in 2016, Republicans were united behind Trump. The Democratic coalition, the old Obama coalition, splintered. Some people went from Obama to Trump. Many more people voted third party or stayed at home. And so if you have unity, if you have a candidate that can, you know, keep all the people that Hillary had and then bring back those people that stayed home and then voted third party, then you would have more than enough people to win.
So you're pointing to the existence of polarization that locks in voters for a certain party, but isn't it the largest group is of people who vote are independents, and then there are a whole lot of people who don't vote, which the Bernie Sanders campaign claims it is able to attract. So I wonder if you could address the non-binary party voters.
Yeah. Well, polarization extends beyond party membership. I mean, a lot of people who are independent say they're independent because they don't like one or aspect of the party or the other, but they pretty reliably vote for that party. But beyond that, if you're like a true independent, then Bernie is a candidate that holds best among independents. And yeah, and there is the aspect that he's drawing in people who underperformed in 2016 and who we need to get out, which is like young people and working class people, so that he has the real promise that I think he's shown in previous elections are bringing people into the system who otherwise would not vote. So I think that all changes the equation.
Yes, and Jeet here also, then why is he being so opposed by the establishment wing of the Democratic Party? You know, it's a puzzle to me, since he really bids fair to enlarge the party's membership so much. So talk about what the Democrats are doing right now. That is, you know, Tom Perez, his actions with the DNC, and how it seems to a lot of outsiders that they're trying to put their thumb on the scale.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things about the Democratic establishment, which is, one is that they have their own theory of the electorate, which is different than Sanders. Their theory is that you can't really expand the vote, but what you can do is you can win over Republican voters. And so their whole goal is to win over suburban Republicans who are disaffected with Trump. And they have had some success with that. Even in 2016, I mean, Hillary Clinton did very well in some suburban counties where Democrats usually don't, and that carried over to the midterm. And so that's their theory of the election. I mean, I think the problem from my point of view of that theory is that there's actually, what you're doing is you're going after college-educated Republicans. And first of all, these people are, to win them, you have to moderate yourself. And to moderate yourself, you're going to turn off people who are traditional Democrats. And the second problem with that is that there are many more non-college educated people than there are college educated people. And if you tailor a message to that one group, you really risk demobilizing the larger majority of voters. And I think that's what happened in 2016.
As you look at what Tom Perez did in stacking the committees of the DNC with party establishment figures, that caused a lot of distress among, I think, many people in the Democratic base. Is this just a done deal, or what are the kinds of, forces in the Democratic Party that can fight for more policies that are more friendly to the progressive base?
Well, I think that the stacking of the at the convention will be a problem if there's no majority going in. That the if no one has a majority of delegates, then those people at the convention will have a lot of power to shape things. I think that the one way around it is really if Bernie can actually go into the convention with a majority of delegates, or possibly if he has a majority with Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I think it's really you have to have the numbers going in. And beyond that, I mean, I think it's just the same way you'd normally do politics, which is that you have to have people organize and agitate, and you have to have the Bernie delegates who are going to go to the convention. They have to be pushing back on all these committees. I mean, I think unfortunately what Perez has done is he's created a situation which might be a replay of 2016, where there'll be a lot of tensions in these committees between the people running them and the actual delegates. Who represent actual voters. And it'll be really a drama about the fight within the party.
So now let's turn to the piece that came out today as we speak. Michael Bloomberg is the rich man's Donald Trump. This was very interesting. Of course, this is coming off of the fact that the DNC, which refused to change its debate rules for any other candidate, gave special treatment to Bloomberg, allowing him to go on the next debate stage in spite of the fact that he doesn't have grassroots donations of any kind at all, and he's already spent $250 million.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Bloomberg himself has created the situation because he is doing well now in the polls. So he also kind of has an advantage in the sense that he has so much money. He's putting out advertising and he's not being able to be challenged by the other candidates. So I know some of the other candidates, or at least their campaigns, wanted Bloomberg in the debates just because, that would be their chance to challenge him. I feel like the Elizabeth Warren campaign really had that goal in mind. But, I mean, yeah, it is a really striking thing. I mean, there are now more billionaires in the Democratic field than there are people of color. I mean, what does that say about the party?
Yeah. And so why do you say he would be the rich man's Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, they're both kind of like these New York guys who have kind of, have media savvy, very obnoxious, very much into the politics of insult and domination. And the thing with Bloomberg is he really is a billionaire and Donald Trump only pretends to be. And they're both, kind of interested in using politics to further their own economic ends. I mean, Trump most blatantly with the sort of tax cuts for the rich. But even Bloomberg, I mean, one reason he's in here is he doesn't like the prospect of Sanders or Warren winning because they'll have this wealth tax, which would, cut into, and he's the 14th richest man in the world. He would end up paying, quite a bit of taxes if those other candidates win. So I kind of think, to me, they seem like very similar figures.
And he touts his, Bloomberg touts his climate policies as his action on climate and on guns. Although for those of us who know New York City intimately, we can see a lot of contradictions with his climate policy, having developed so much luxury housing right in the wake of rising sea levels at the shore. I wonder if you could talk about Bloomberg's positions as a candidate and how do they mesh or not mesh with the majority of the Democratic base?
Sure, yeah. I mean, on the climate thing and on the guns, I mean, I will say, you know, he has broadly right policies, but he has also very much a sort of top-down approach. He has a sort of management approach to these things, you know, like, which is all you come up with the policies and people will accept them. And I think in both cases, you kind of need a more grassroots movement. And I think that's true of him. And I mean, first of all, the thing to say about Bloomberg is he's a Republican for most of his life. You know, he supported George W. Bush. He supported John McCain in 2008. And even as recently as 2016, he gave a lot of money to some Republican senators because he wanted to keep the Senate Republican. Gave money to Pat Comey in Pennsylvania. So many of his policies, you know, he has had progressive policies, but he's also had stop and frisk. And he's really, the more general thing about him is he's very sort of authoritarian and paternalistic, that he really sort of empowered the police. And they had, like, you know, like the sort of racial profiling of Muslims, surveillance of Muslims. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things in his records that are very spotty. I would also add that, you know, like Donald Trump, he has a kind of Me Too issues where, like, you know, there's a lot of accusations of sort of sexual harassment in the culture of Bloomberg, the Bloomberg's company, and sort of a history of very, you know, unpleasant remarks about women.
So you have written here about the need for party unity. Talk more about that. Is there any way that you think that those who are in the elite ranks of the Democratic Party will ever be able to accept Sanders or even a Warren nomination?
I think that's going to be the real issue. I mean, like, I feel like, you know, right now they don't seem that way. And you listen to that, you watch MSNBC, right? Like, Chris Matthews is like, I don't know about this Bernie guy. He reminds me of these guys you see in anti-war protests who are handing out leaflets. You know, like, it's a real problem. I think ultimately they're going to have like a wake-up call in the morning. They're going to have to wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning and think, do I really want 4 more years of Trump? And can the planet survive 4 more years of Trump? There's a line in Milton's Paradise Lost where Satan says, it is better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven, meaning that Satan would rather prefer to dominate over and in defeat in hell rather than be a junior partner to God in heaven. And I really feel that a lot of the Democratic elite have that attitude. It's better for them to, you know, be the boss of a losing coalition than the junior partner of a winning one.
In effect, putting their own personal interest over the interests of the country and perhaps the world.
That's right. That's right. I think ultimately, they're going to have a wake-up call because the stakes are existential. The stakes are as high as they could possibly be. Are they really so committed to holding on to their power within the party that they're not going to be able to make compromise? They have to compromise.
Jeet here of The Nation. Go to writersvoice.net to find the links to his articles. The electability argument is really about party unity, and Michael Bloomberg is the rich man's Donald Trump. Coming up soon on Writer's Voice, we talk with filmmakers Rachel Reichman and Deborah Schaefer about their fascinating documentary about the feminist artist Audrey Flack. It's called Queen of Hearts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.